I'll never forget, there was a moment where we were in Sao Paulo and we were all pulled into a room. And this all hands was kind of thrown on our calendar last minute. It's September. We're kind of like, ooh, what's going on? This seems a bit odd. They pull down the huge projector. Adam Neumann is on the screen. But he's not wearing his usual t-shirt that says "We Work" or "We Love" or whatever. He's wearing a suit and tie. And in that moment, Adam Neumann announced that he was stepping out of the CEO role of WeWork. A rug had been taken out from underneath us. And your team is just a mirror of you. And if you demonstrate or show any type of distress, stress, happiness, whatever, that's what your team is going to show.
Hi, welcome to Path to Growth. I'm Tracy Young, co-founder and CEO of TigerEye. Today we are joined by Caroline McCloskey, go-to-market for startups at OpenAI. Caroline has worked for many companies, including AWS, LinkedIn, and WeWork, where she has built and led sales team, developed training programs, and driven international expansion efforts. Caroline, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So tell me about yourself. Tell me about mom and dad, how they've influenced your work style or career choices in any way.
Great question. So my parents, both of them were very important to informing my career paths, I would say. My mom was a executive at a satellite company and famously actually started her career as a flight attendant. So she was always someone, well, is always someone that likes to travel and learn and collect new experiences. And that's always been something that I've looked up to and always something that I've wanted to have in my career. It definitely inspired me to travel well, or at least seize opportunities to travel for work as well. My dad did something quite different. He is a prosecutor, specifically a criminal prosecutor. And I had entertained the idea of law school at one point. I really was convinced when I graduated from Berkeley that I was going to do a JD MBA and try and be both my parents at the same time, but ultimately decided to kind of stick to more of the business route. But it definitely always appealed to me to potentially go into law, but I just decided to focus my path on tech.
Mm-hmm. It's so clear to me how proud you are of your parents. Where'd you grow up?
I grew up in the Netherlands. So we moved there when I was 4. We were living in DC before that, but I spent most of my childhood growing up in The Hague, 45 minutes away from Amsterdam. And yeah, I went to a British school growing up. And all my friends were from all over the place. So it was a fun place to grow up.
Thanks for sharing that with us.
Yeah, of course.
How do you explain your job to a 5-year-old?
Our team helps small companies do really big things with AI. We work with some of the most exciting companies that are building the coolest technology. And sometimes I get to just have conversations about people building very, very cool stuff. And that's my job on a day-to-day basis.
You've held so many go-to-market leadership roles, and you've been responsible for strategy, revenue operations, and sales enablement, including international expansion. This background is obviously beneficial to your new role at OpenAI. Can you talk a little bit more about just how you think your experience helps you? You know, because you talk to so many new companies all the time, I guess, both empathize with them and also help them see through their vision.
It's a great question. I've always leaned towards the generalist approach in my career. That's how I really started my career, is when I was at LinkedIn. We did this leadership rotation program where you do a little bit of everything. You do a bit of recruiting, you do a bit of customer operations, you do a bit of, you know, sales, and then ultimately you end up in a full-time cycle sales role. And I've always prioritized like kind of collecting those experiences and putting them in a toolbox, as one of my former mentors, Gordon Tobin, would call it. And, you know, I think that has leaned well in my current experience, because I'm talking to all different types of companies all day. I mean, most of them are building on AI and are AI native companies, but they're all in very different industries, or they're all supporting very different industries, from, you know, healthcare to transportation and trucking to B2B SaaS. And I think just having had experience across a wide range of those different industries and a wide range of those different business models, it's given me the ability to have a bit more of a relatable experience with them, and just being able to have and sustain a conversation, because ultimately that's what I'm, you know, what I do on a day-to-day is it's very relationship oriented and understanding what business challenges these guys have.
Let's talk about some patterns you've seen over the years now working with so many startups. What are the common challenges startups face when building and scaling their go-to-market efforts?
Yeah, I've seen this in a couple different shades, but I would say the one that sticks out to me the most and reminds me of a story that I experienced was at WeWork. And the challenge that we faced was, it didn't really seem like a challenge at first, but it posed itself in that light a little bit later. But hiring and scaling teams very, very fast can be very fun and very exciting. However, it can be exhausting, and in the long term can be something that, at least in my experience, that what I saw at WeWork, we had to sort of unravel that and undo it over time. When I started at WeWork, we were just shy of 2,000 employees there. And at one point, I was there when there were 17,000. And by the time that I left, we were down to just under 4,000. So that was over the course of about 4.5 years. So the way that I saw that translate into my team and the challenges that our go-to-market team faced was that we were hiring like crazy. At one point, my VP told me, hey, you have headcount for 300 people in Latin America, which a questionable number to begin with. And the first thing you do is you're kind of just in shock and disbelief. Like, how am I going to even find 300 people to do this job? Like, this, I don't even know if there are 300 people in this country that I could hire to do this. So it always poses itself as this challenge, because while you are excited for, oh my gosh, so much more leadership responsibility, so much more, you know, so many opportunities to find and talk to amazing new talent, right-sizing that later is really hard. And it results in having to part ways with people that you otherwise wouldn't have wanted to do that with. It results in you having to learn some pretty rough lessons about talent calibration pretty quickly. And, you know, when someone is performing or not performing, like, you kind of get a sense pretty quickly of if they're going to be a good fit to your team. And if you're in that rigor of performance management, it's very tough to maintain and sustain that pace during a hyper-growth period where you're hiring like crazy. So I would say that is the consistent challenge that I saw, not only at WeWork, but at some of the other companies I worked with as well.
Yeah, it's too easy to, especially after closing a big funding round, to think, oh, I'm going to solve all my problems by just bringing on all these people. And by the way, you know, the investors are pushing for a higher revenue target. I remember tripling our team one year, and boy, was that painful. Much smaller team sizes than you've spoken of course, but suddenly the team's three times bigger, and it's like, wait, why are we moving slower? Why does none of our processes work? Oh, right, because we just don't have the right managers in place to just lead this new crew. And meanwhile, there's so many human problems that didn't come up before. When you see growth like that, the people who are really ambitious are really looking for leadership roles, or, you know, there's more elbowing that happens that wasn't there before. And that was all new to me. I remember I promised myself that year, I was like, I'm never going to triple the team ever again.
Oh, famous last words.
Yeah. You had this amazing experience of getting the opportunity to lead go-to-market in LATAM and starting a sales team in Mexico and Brazil during your time at WeWork. So tell us more about just like tactically how that even happens. I'm assuming you're going to have to fly down to Mexico and Brazil and learn more and get yourself up to speed, but tell us about that journey.
That was an exciting one. So I was about 8 months in to WeWork. at the time. I had just relocated from San Francisco to New York, and it was the first time that I was living in New York City. And while I was loving it, it was crazy. Mm-hmm. For anyone that's lived in New York knows that it can be a very overwhelming at times. And, you know, I was working a lot. It was early days WeWork. We're talking 2017. And there was a moment where my old VP, we were in a room and we were talking about our global expansion plans. And one of my colleagues, Maria, was super excited because she just decided that she was going to move to London to expand the team. And I was like, wow, that sounds kind of fun. I wonder if there are other teams that they would like take a chance on a 24-year-old to go move and build a team from scratch. And I think within like a week, Adam pulled me into his office and was like, hey, we're hiring for these two international roles. Can you help me interview some of these managers? And I was like, interview the managers? What about me? I'll do it. I'll go to Mexico. I'll go to Brazil. Like, what do you need to do? And he was like, wait, are you serious? You would move to Mexico. I was like, yeah, why not? He's like, do you even speak Spanish? I was like, intermediate level, which is true. I had okay level Spanish at that time.
It's going to get a lot better. Don't worry.
Yeah. I was really banking on that. So it was two conversations later and I was already in the process of getting my visa processed for Mexico. And I ended up moving in February of 2018. So about three to four month period of evaluation and considering the move, et cetera. And at that point, the team was only like three or four people. We had a couple reps in Mexico, one rep in Argentina, and one rep in Brazil. And the team was quite decentralized. There weren't really standardized processes. Everything was a little bit all over the place. And here comes this American girl to try and standardize things from HQ, which at the time, I mean, my boss Eduardo will laugh about this, but I would come into the meetings and then everyone would switch from Spanish to English. It was like, oh, la gringa, she doesn't understand anything. So like we had to slow down until she learned Spanish very quickly. And I was like, okay, just give me a couple months, guys. I'll catch up. So moved down there and the immediate remit was to hire at scale. So like I said, one of the harder things to deal with. But before I even moved to Mexico, I had already sent out maybe 15 offers to folks to start on the sales team in Sao Paulo and in Mexico City. So I had already been interviewing virtually and doing all that stuff. And by the time that I landed, within 2 weeks, we started the training of the whole team. The team basically went from 3 to 4 people to 16 people overnight when I arrived. So over the course of 2 and a bit years, I had the opportunity to go to Brazil once every 3 or 4 months. Because half my team was down there, mm-hmm. and found myself in a situation where I was constantly learning so much from my team. Who was not very much the other way around. They were the ones that were really telling me about Mexican culture, about Colombian culture, about Brazilian culture, and helping understand what the nuances were across the region. Because you couldn't just apply a standard go-to-market playbook that you would in New York mm-hmm. or whatever to one process in one country, and that was like something that I really had to try and emphasize to our HQ team, like, hey, we can't just do the same thing across all the different markets in Latin America. That's not going to make sense. So I had to work really closely with like the local team in Mexico and in Argentina and in Brazil to make sure that we could adapt our strategies, because anytime that I said that we needed to standardize something, they were kind of almost having an allergic reaction. They were like, no, we need to treat this differently. We need to have this process be slightly nuanced for us. So It was overall an incredible learning experience, but it definitely didn't come without its challenges too.
Oh, yeah. So what's the advice? If you could time warp back to the start of when you took that new role, what's the advice you would give the younger Caroline?
It's a very good question. Maybe start taking Portuguese lessons too. No, I don't know if my brain could have physically handled that. I think the advice that I would give given myself is to breathe and slow down. I think I got very caught up in the pace and the excitement of having a lot of leadership responsibility very quickly. And while I did really make some excellent hiring decisions, there were some that were really rushed and I paid for later personally, not because of that person, but it was really difficult. And I think if I had pumped the brakes a little bit and allowed myself to take a bit more time and not have to be the first team that is staffed as quickly as possible in Latin America, like for the sales team compared to the other regions, like I was holding myself to this bar of like speed. And I think if I had slowed down a little bit, or at least, I don't know if slowing down would have been an option, but at least just like making sure that I could pace myself, that would have been good. But again, we worked during hypergrowth. There was nothing quite like it. So it's hard. It's easier said than done.
It sounds like if you had taken a breath and slowed down, you might have gotten a few of the important hires right. Mm-hmm. That it's all about people in the end, and you're just having the time to evaluate them.
Yes, I would say so. I definitely got some of those early hires right. One of them was Carolina Berard. She was the first person that I hired in, first leader that I hired in Brazil. And she basically was able to completely transform that business and grew the team 2 to 3x. And then she ended up hiring another manager later down the line. And she basically made the Brazil team like a self-sufficient organism. Was a little bit of a different story in Mexico without going into too much detail.
What's the signs? What's the like common signs you see when someone isn't working out?
It's hard to
say. Is anyone just so different? Like there's different flavors of red flags.
Yeah, I think there are so many different flavors of red flags. I think, and it's very different for a leader versus a rep, right? For a rep, if you're a seller or if you are an individual contributor that is generating revenue that has some type of process that you're supposed to follow, if you're not able to keep up with like the standard KPIs that are expected of you within the first 3 months, I can't possibly expect you to improve necessarily after the 3 month period, because it's a very routinized job. And if you're not really getting it as quickly as some of the baseline other reps are getting it, 3 months was usually kind of my time frame of understanding, is this person going to get it or not? Different story with leaders. I think you need to vet leaders in a very different way. Like references are very, very important, et cetera. And I think how they mesh not only with you as the person hiring them and the reps, the people that they're going to lead, but how they balance the other leaders on the team is just as important. And to me, it was a red flag when I saw that managers weren't gelling. I was like, oh, some equilibrium is now off and I don't know what's going on. I can't diagnose this overnight. This is very complicated, but not really considering the impact of like how this hire will affect the rest of my leadership team. Cause at one point I had 5 managers reporting to me. The balance was just completely off. And that was the initial red flag. And it shows up in how people present themselves in team meetings and how people are communicating with you and how people are talking about their team and their performance and maybe justifying behavior.
Yeah, and it can be as subtle as using the right pronouns, especially talking about wins, right? It's like correct. We versus I.
Yes, that's a perfect example, actually. We versus I, them versus us.
Yeah.
Being kind of vindictive and being like, oh, this person's not performing. It's like, okay, well, maybe let's uncover why they're not performing. Or have you coached with them in this angle? Have you tried this talk track? Like, you know, I think grit is something that's like the number one thing that I look for when you're hiring someone. So if they just start to demonstrate the opposite of that, which is like either complaining or whining or something. Then you're like, this is going to be an interesting fit.
Yeah. I find that especially with sales and marketing leaders, a big red flag for me is when I stop enjoying having one-on-ones with them. You know, things can be completely broken. Everything can be on fire, but I should feel very comfortable with getting on a Zoom call, you know, being in person, hopping on a phone call, because this is my person who's going to help me solve all these problems versus like, oh man.
Just bringing problems with you. And just,
like, I've got so much mud already.
Right.
I can't stand it.
Exactly.
It's just going to be a bunch of complaints with nothing resolved. And then I want to go deal with their ego. How do you align sales, marketing, and product teams? Like, what do you see work?
Yeah. Oh, I mean, I think a perfect example of this was my how my old, he led Latin America, essentially, for WeWork. His name's Eduardo. He was my direct manager for the time that I was in Mexico. And he was always someone that was able to get all the different teams on the same page. And we're talking WeWork. We're talking product. We're talking the physical buildings or the people that are in the community. We're talking the sales team, the marketing team, all of those people. And the, what he would do was he really fostered a very strong sense of belonging. He leaned in very heavily to culture on the team. He leaned into having a lot of transparent communication. I remember every single Monday we would have TGIM, just thank God it's Monday. It was a very WeWork thing, if anyone remembers that. And Eduardo would never miss one. He would always show up. He would always be there. He would always be the first one there, the last one to leave. And he would always use that opportunity to really communicate with transparency. And during the time of WeWork, that was precious. You know, there was a lot of stuff happening in HQ that we weren't privy to, that maybe I had some exposure to because I still had connections to people in New York, but a lot of the teams in Mexico that were based here and local employees of Mexico were not getting that exposure. So Eduardo did a really good job just tying all the loose ends, fostering that community, making sure that communication was really clear, and just ultimately making sure that everyone had a good time. He was always good at that.
One of my favorite bosses I've ever worked for was actually in construction, a senior superintendent named Alan. And Alan just made sure that everyone on the job site knew what we were trying to do. And if there's changes, and the changes would usually be in construction, it's logistics. It's like, this is the staging area, this is the entrance, now we've moved it over here for XYZ reasons. He would just make sure that everyone understood why he had made the decisions he made, because oftentimes with logistics and staging and deliveries, it's hard, it's difficult, you know, everyone's stuffing over everyone. But as long as everyone understood why he had made that decision, it was like, even if they didn't agree, they're like, all right, you know, I can understand, I might've made a different decision, but I'm going to commit. And that's really helped me just model the type of leader I want to be. And it sounds like for him, he was, you know, overly transparent, made sure that everyone knew where he was at, where he was coming from, and why he was making the decisions he was making.
Yeah, I would say that's absolutely right.
All right, let's switch gears. Trust in leaders can be made or broken when things get tough. How do you deal with a crisis?
Again, tying back to some of the experiences I had in the literal crisis that was WeWork's failure of an S-1 and going public, I emulated what a lot of the leaders around me were doing, or at least had tried to coach me. And there are a couple things. One was just, as I mentioned, Eduardo. I'll never forget, there was a moment where we were in Sao Paulo on a trip. It was September 2019. And we were all pulled into a room, into the big common room, one of the bigger HQ offices in the Sao Paulo, Brazil office. So like all of the employees were there. And this all hands was kind of thrown on our calendar last minute. It's September. We're kind of like, ooh, what's going on? This seems a bit odd. They pull down the huge projector. Adam Neumann is on the screen. But he's not wearing his usual t-shirt that says "We Work" or "We Love" or whatever. He's wearing a suit and tie. And this like tenor shift it kind of put a pit in my stomach, and my whole team was around me. Like my whole team in Brazil, I think we were 21 people at that point. And we were with that team, Eduardo's other sales teams, and some marketing folks. And anyway, basically a lot of people in Latin America. And in that moment, Adam Neumann announced that he was stepping out of the CEO role at WeWork. And, you know, even though we were far away from where this announcement was taking place in New York, like it felt like a rug had been taken out from underneath us. We were all just like, what? what are you talking about? No, this can't be real. Like people, there was not only that, but people were like confused as to what he was talking about from like a language perspective. Like it was just, it became pretty chaotic pretty quickly. And, you know, when that conference call ended and, you know, I think our, we had like a temporary CFO or temporary C, we had like another CEO step in. I mean, the team was very confused. I was super confused, but I needed to just remain calm. And advice that I had gotten from Holly Proctor, who's someone I worked with at LinkedIn and I've had the fortune of getting very good advice from over the years. She said, your team is just a mirror of you. And if you demonstrate or show any type of distress, stress, happiness, whatever, that's what your team is going to show. And if you can remain calm and collected in moments of crisis, or at least to some extent, like you have some control over your emotion, that's going to go a long way as far as making sure that your team feels the same way. So in that moment, I didn't run around like a crazy person thinking, oh my gosh, are we all going to lose our jobs? You know, you take that moment to breathe and reflect and just like stay calm and collected. And I can't say that my team was all super calm and collected. That would be crazy. But I think just remembering the impact that you can have just from leading by example is really important. And then also remembering your responsibility as a leader to shield your team from corporate BS in like an umbrella happen, you know, like my reaction in that moment is one thing, but the downstream effects of all of that, okay, now we have to do restructuring, we have to do a reduction in force, we have to shut down offices, all that information is intel and process that I needed to completely block my team from. Like they did not need to know all the details. They did not need to see how stressed I was about the fact that I needed to reduce the team size by 10, 50% in basically 2 weeks. That's not stuff that I was able to share with them, and I had to shield them from that. So being that kind of, for lack of a better word, shit umbrella was very important. And learning that skill is, you kind of only learn it by doing it.
As you're speaking, it really reminds me, I've got three young kids, and especially when they like hurt themselves, you know, they like trip and fall and it's not that bad. And they'll immediately just look at me. And, you know, if I'm like, oh no, are you okay? Are you okay? And then they'll just immediately like the waterworks come down. Right. But if I just keep calm and I stare at them, I was like, are you all right? Looks okay. Looks like you're not bleeding. And they're like, oh yeah, I'm totally cool. I'm fine.
Exactly. It's like the energy you put out, you're going to get back.
Mm-hmm. So there's obviously nuances to every company's business, but what are your favorite go-to-market metrics that you think every company should care about, regardless of, you know, the product they're producing?
Yeah, this is a hard one for me because I've been in so many different versions and shapes of go-to-market orgs that I think the first rule is that there is no like standard KPI that anyone can look at. You know, the type of business and the types of metrics we were looking at Cameo were fundamentally different than the ones we were looking at WeWork, which were fundamentally different from the ones you're looking at AWS. And, you know, productivity metrics at a high level, I think activity is always a good thing to look at, especially in more of the not junior roles, but like the roles that are kind of your first or second sales role. I think it's really important to hold young and career folks accountable to KPIs, such as like number of meetings set, number of opportunities set, just general pipeline metrics, I think are always good because it just helps them structure their day and learn and build the muscle. But again, what those KPIs actually are is going to be completely different depending on which team, what type of company you're working at. Like if you're working at Cameo, I think that one of the things that we looked at was like number of Instagram DMs. Something completely different from what you would do if you were running a business at AWS. So for lack of a better answer, general productivity KPIs and then tailoring them to whatever success actually looks like for your business.
Specific to your role now, what advice would you give a startup that's beginning to implement LLMs in their areas of business, other than, you know, deploy OpenAI?
Yeah,
can't what should they think about?
Yeah. I think it's important to distinguish between implementing LLMs as, like, you know, as a afterthought or a, oh, everyone's doing AI, so we need to do AI now, versus building a startup that is an AI native company and building something that is completely oriented towards an AI driven use case. And I would recommend, give different recommendations based on those two use cases, whether or not your company is native to AI or not. And I think that we've seen a lot of companies evolve in the last, since ChatGPT and all of this became very popularized in 2022, we've seen a lot of companies pop up that are general AI productivity boosts, or, you know, they're a chatbot for insert use case. And I think the startups that will succeed and the companies that will succeed the most are the ones that cannot just think about, okay, how is this existing model of whatever LLM I'm building on top of, whether it's OpenAI or Anthropic or whoever, not just how is this model going to work for my business, but how is, like, AI in 10 years going to look? Obviously, no one really knows, right? But how are advancements in AI going to impact my company's ability to have a product that actually can stand the test of time? Because a lot of folks will build something and then realize, oh man, maybe if one of these bigger companies comes out with a product release that is, you know, 10 times more intelligent than its previous model, maybe this feature will be a little redundant. We see that happen sometimes. And I think it's important to kind of recognize that by no means do we expect that models that we're building on right now are not going to improve. Like, the whole goal is that they get cheaper and more effective over time. So I think just being aware that you're not operating in a static moment when you're building on AI is very important.
Yeah, that is a truth that we believe in, or a thesis that we believe in, is that AI is going to get a lot better and it's going to get a lot cheaper, and we're just running with it. And so it seems like your advice is think longer term, think bigger, and really focus on what value you are adding for the customers.
Yeah, it's a good summary.
My last question for you, and I can talk to you for another hour, but I'm going to let you go soon. For people early on in their career that are ambitious, what should they be doing more or less of? What's your, like, parting advice for our listeners, really?
Spend less time dropping your resume into random LinkedIn job descriptions or LinkedIn job posts, and spend more time building relationships with people that you think that their job is interesting, or you think that what they're doing is fascinating. I say that because every single job that I have ever gotten has been the result of not a completely blind job application, with the exception of my first job, actually. But it's been a result of direct outreach on LinkedIn or on text or whatever to someone that I know that has a relationship either with the company that I'm interested in or an opportunity in the space that they're in. And the only reason that I felt like I had enough currency to reach out to that person is because I have a relationship with them. And I think building those relationships early on is really important. And I think that you can go through your first couple jobs as someone who's just out of college or just out of, you know, whatever program, and maybe trying to learn all the different things about business and all the different jobs. But it's really important to just have the coffee with the leader that you're intimidated by. Send the email or the thank you note to the speaker that dropped in to your class in business school. Do those little things to just plant little kernels of what a relationship could be. And some of the closest relationships that I have are with people that, you know, that I worked with them distantly at one company, and then I worked with them again at another company. And one perfect example of that is someone named Aaron, who we worked together at LinkedIn kind of distantly, but, you know, I kind of knew of him. And then when I saw that he came to WeWork, I wrote him a message. We started getting coffee. At some point in WeWork, he actually became my direct manager by complete coincidence. But now he's someone that I have a trusted relationship with and I go to for every single career move that I want to make. Like I ask, hey, Aaron, what do you think? And building those relationships is just, it's priceless. So I would focus on that.
That resonates with me too. Some of my best friends are people I've worked with many times. And I would say that having been in startups for a long time now, the best memories are always with people. I mean, yes, you know, it's like so amazing to like hit our number and like launch these products. But when I really think back at the best moments, there's just some like random moment with them and like laughing about something or feeling really good about finishing a project together and getting something hard done together.
Absolutely.
Caroline, it's been so nice talking to you. Thank you so much for sharing your war stories with us.
Of course. Thank you. It was an honor to be here. I appreciate it.